Hi, I'm an Allen Nunn from Alabama, and my name's Bo Templin. Hey, y'all. I'm glad to be here. Glad to be here. Do y'all understand y'all is a one-syllable word? Okay. Let's get this thing started right. I'm gonna try my best to not talk too fast. But I got about 3 hours of stuff here I need to get in. And we got to get started on this. Are y'all as full as I am? Yeah. Good lunch. A couple of thank yous I want to get done here before I get into talking a little Al-Anon. First thank yous, I want to thank Lou Ann, and I want to thank the Las Vegas Roundup Committee that thought enough of me and my bride to extend the invitation for us to come out here and be a part of this party. And that's what this weekend, folks. This is a party. And we were introduced to this way of life, and I'll talk to you a little bit about that. We were introduced to this way of life Labor Day weekend 1982 at the party. And we fell in love with the party. Now we know you gotta go to those meetings, you gotta have that home group, you gotta do that sponsor work, you gotta implement those spiritual principles. We know you got to do all that, but we love the parties. And for you newcomers that are here, join in the party. That's what this is. It's a celebration of recovery this weekend. And we're glad to be here with you, and we're glad to be a part of the party. I want to introduce my wife. My wife Shirley is with me, and I was trying to think of what's the best way, you know, to introduce her. And I think the best way to do this is tell you about an experience I had 6-8 months ago when I was at a conference and speaking in a deal like this. And Shirley wasn't with me. We try our best to go together, and this conference believes in that too. And so they brought both of us out here, even though she's not on the program. And that's a big thank you. And so anyhow, I was by myself that weekend, and I was going in there to the speaker meetings, you know, and it was an AA conference with Al-Anon participation. And so I was the token Al-Anon there. And so went in there for Friday night, and they had two AA speakers back to back, and the person gets up to chair the meeting, and he comes up to the mic and, "Hi, my name's so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic, and through God's grace and the wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous and implementing the 12 steps in my life on a daily basis and good sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since." And he gave us sobriety date. And then he introduced the one that was going to read how it works. "My name's so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic, and through God's grace and the wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps and spiritual principles and good sponsorship, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since." And this went all the way down through everybody that was on the program. And then we had another speaker meeting. And we went through the same thing again. And so I'm speaking Saturday morning. So I get up there Saturday morning, walk up to the podium, and here's this piece of paper that's taped to the podium. So I said, "Hi, I'm an Al-Anon. My name's Bo. And through God's grace and the wonderful 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, good, strong sponsorship, and implementing the 12 spiritual principles in her life, my wife has not had to take a drink since July the 29th of 1982. That's my wife, Shirley. John left out of here. I hated that he left so quick. John's the taper, Las Vegas taping. And I want to say a thank you to the tapers for being here. You know, we get here and we're part of the party, and we're partying around and jumping around, and the tapers are working. They work real hard while this thing's going on, especially a roundup as big as this one and with so many things going on and taping so many different meetings. And it's a great, great way to carry the message. It's through tapes. And the tapers around the country do a great, great job. And I always try to remember to thank the tapers. But here's how this came about. I didn't always thank the tapers. I'm sponsored by Old Timers. And as I talk about sponsorship as we go along, you'll get an idea of what old-time sponsorship is. And you'll know probably before you leave here if you've got old-time sponsorship. Now, one of the things about old-time sponsors is they don't believe in sugarcoating this thing. They don't believe in watering it down. They love you enough that they get right up in your face and tell you just exactly what you need to hear. And that's the kind of sponsorship I've been blessed with since I got here September the 4th, 1982. And my sponsors know that I've got an out-of-town talk because they know about my ego. Now, I've never had enough courage yet to make that out-of-town talk. But I've got one. Well, man, you ought to hear it. I give it a lot of times in the shower, you know. But my sponsors know that I'm capable, so this is the way my sponsors treat me. They never tell me, but they know when I go off to one of these things that the tapers are going to be there. And that when I leave, the tapers are going to give me a copy of my talk. And so I never know when I get home which talk my sponsors are going to say, bring over and let me listen to. They don't ask to listen to all of them, but I know that they're going to ask on a fairly routine, regular basis. So I'd been out of town one weekend and had a real good time and got back home and called and checked in. And my sponsor said, well, it's about time we listen to see what you're saying. So why don't you come over tomorrow afternoon and we'll have the coffee made and let's listen to that tape. And so I got over there that afternoon and the coffee was made and we sat down there and we plugged that cassette in. And Luann, they got the meeting open and then they introduced me. And just about the time that I walked up there and got started with my talk, that tape said, hum. And it went on and on. You couldn't make out what I was saying. And I looked at Jim, one of my sponsors, and I said, well, there's something wrong with the man's equipment. You can't even. And Jim started laughing. He said, there ain't nothing wrong with the man's equipment, Bo. You didn't thank the taper. So turn the hum off, John. I have thanked the taper. I want to make sure that we don't have the hum in this talk. You know, it's great for us to get to come to these things. We're fortunate God's good to us and we get to go to a lot of places. And we made friends just all over. And we know when we go to these things that we're going to see some old friends. Some of you folks that I've already met before, Shirley and I have, in different places. And some of you, we kind of think about, you know, and we say, well, they live up in that area, and maybe we'll run into them. Maybe they'll be there at this one. Of course, we're always excited about making the new friends. But every once in a while, you just get totally blown away. And you look up, and you see somebody walking in the door, and you say, what in the world are they doing here? And this happened to me just a few minutes ago as we were sitting there at the table. And I looked over there at the door, and I looked at Shirley, and I said, Shirley, that's Bob C. And she looked away. She said, by golly, I believe. I said, if that's not Bob C. from Atlanta, Georgia, that's his twin brother. And sure enough, he came right on over to the table. And Bob, it's so good to see you. Dadgummit, we live 125, 30 miles from each other, and we have to come out to Las Vegas to run into each other. God love you. It's good to see you today, buddy, and I'm glad you're here. He's good AA. Good AA. So, I got one more thank you and then we're going to talk about some stuff. If you're sitting in this room with me today and you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to talk to you for just a minute. Then we'll get to Al-Anon. But first, if you're sitting in here and you are a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, please give me your attention for just a minute. Because what I want to say is I want to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for two reasons. Number one, thank you for being there a little over 18 years ago when my gal reached out her hand. Because you see, I'd lost her. The bottle had her and I couldn't do anything about it. And I was driving myself crazy trying to find a way to get her sober and keep her sober. And I couldn't do that. But Shirley had her moment of clarity that I believe all recovering people had. And she reached out her hand, you had the hand of AA there for her. And you took her in and you put your arms around her. And you didn't put any conditions on her, you didn't make any rules. You just put your arms around her. And you loved her back to life. Because you see, my wife was dying of a disease that we didn't even know she had. Dying of a fatal disease called alcoholism, and we didn't know anything about it. And you put your arms around her and you loved her back to health. And as a result of her getting involved in AA and me getting involved in something called Al-Anon and two kids being introduced to something called Al-Ateen, we was able to put that family back together. And because of AA, Al-Anon, and Al-Ateen in our lives and in our family, we put that family back together. And this past April, we celebrated anniversary number 36. You see, we couldn't have done it without you. I want to thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for another reason. I want to thank you for knowing from the very beginning that this thing called alcoholism is a family disease. Now, you see, I know that you knew it was a family disease because I'm one of those Al-Anons that's been raised in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm one of those Al-Anons that's been taught to read and study the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's there in your book that I find out that you knew from the very beginning, because there's two chapters in that book to the wives and family after, dedicated to us. If you've been sponsored by old-timers like I've been sponsored by, you've been taught the history of our fellowships. And if you've been taught the history of our fellowships, then you know that the very first meetings were family meetings. And the family was included. And I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for knowing that and for including us from the very beginning. And in 1951, when it was time for Al-Anon to be born, and we stepped forward and we said, can we have your 12 steps? You loved us enough that you put your arms around us and you said, come on in, Bo. And you can take our 12 steps and you can learn to implement them in your life on a daily basis. And Bo, what we want you to do is, we want you to learn to live happy, joyous, and free. And it not be dependent on what another person does or does not do. And for that, I'm eternally grateful and I say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I introduced myself to you, I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. Let me talk about that for a minute. See, when I got here in September 1982, I thought being married to my alcoholic made me an Al-Anon. What I've learned over the past 18 and a half years is being married to her qualifies me for Al-Anon. It doesn't make me an Al-Anon. And there are several things that I do in my life today on a real regular basis that qualifies me to stand up here and tell you that I'm a member of Al-Anon. When you answer that phone, if that's my sponsor, you tell her I'm here and that I do have a coat and towel. Thank you. But there's several things that I do in order to tell you I'm a member of Al-Anon, and I want to go over three or four of those with you right quick. Number one, because I saw some newcomers raise their hand when we asked about that earlier. And I know that the newcomers, this is valuable information for the newcomers. Number two, I need to hear it. And so I'm going to listen while I tell you about it. The first thing I do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I go to Al-Anon meetings. I suit up and I show up and I occupy a chair in an Al-Anon meeting on a real, real, regular basis. And you shake your head and you say, well, yeah, that's, you know, you got, let me tell you something, folks, travel around the country like we get to do. You're going to find there's a world full of people out there that are claiming to be members of our fellowship and you never see them in a meeting. You never see them in a meeting. Now, I know that there's more to it than going to meetings. I know that this is a program of action. I know that I have to participate in my own recovery and that I can't get this by osmosis. I know that because the first 7 months I was here, I tried to rub up against you and let your recovery rub off on me. And it just didn't work. But it starts with suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair. Here's the story that illustrates it. I take that chair and I take it out to the back of the lot and I set that chair in the middle of the chicken coop. And every day I go out there and every day for 20 years I occupy that chair in the middle of that chicken coop. And I do that every day for 20 years and guess what? I still ain't gonna be a chicken. But let me suggest this to you and think about this. If I do that every day for 20 years, at the end of that time, I'm going to know a whole lot about chickens. And I'm going to know how the successful chickens are getting it done. Do you get my gist? You hear what I'm talking about? It's by occupying that chair in that Al-Anon meeting and being in there with those old-timers and those winners that were there for me and watching them that I begin to get an idea of the changes that I'm going to have to make in my life. So it starts by suiting up, showing up, and occupying that chair in an Al-Anon meeting. The next thing I do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon, and let me tell you now, this is just for me. This is what worked for Bo. Is I have to have a home group. Now, my home group is a Wednesday night discussion group in Bessemer, Alabama. I belong to one of the two best home groups on the face of this earth, and my prayer for you today is that you belong to the other one. I wish that for you. Now, I hope you feel that way about your home group. But when I got here, I didn't need a home group. When I got here, I didn't need Al-Anon because there was nothing wrong with me. But that treatment center my wife went to told her she had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and we did. Now, if you're an Al-Anon, you understand that. But I wasn't going for me. I was going to make sure she was there. Because, see, what I heard them say up there was, I heard them say the ones that go to AA are the ones that stay sober. And my job in life changed in an instant. If the ones that went to AA was the ones that stayed sober, my job in life now was to make sure she was at AA. Yeah. And so we were going to those 90 meetings in 90 days. And we were sitting up there on the front row. And that speaker would get started, and that speaker would say something important, and I'd pop her with that elbow. Yeah. And I was listening real close, because, see, she was still in a fog, and I knew there was going to be questions. And I was going to have to answer those questions. And we'd go into those 90 meetings in 90 days, and then I learned something early on during those 90 meetings in 90 days. I learned that you AAs have got tunnel vision, real tunnel vision, about a few things. And one of the things you've got real serious tunnel vision about is something called closed meetings. Well, we showed up there at that Bessemer group one night, and it was a closed meeting. They met me at the door and said, Bo, this is a closed meeting. It's for alcoholics only, and you're not going to be able to. I said, you don't understand. My new job, I got to have it, you know. They said, no, you don't understand. That you're going to have to learn to turn her over to us. They said, you can't stay in this meeting, but there's a meeting in that other room that you've been needing to go to for a long time. And they hustled me over there and they shoved me in the door of the Bessemer Al-Anon family group there in Bessemer, Alabama. Now, let me tell you about that. See, I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't need a sponsor. Wasn't anything wrong with me. And so I hadn't been told yet to show up 30 minutes early and be prepared to stay till it's over. See, old-time sponsors don't believe in one-hour meetings. Old-time sponsors tell you show up at least 30 minutes early, prepared to stay till it's over, until we're done. Some of the greatest meetings I've ever been in have been the meeting after the meeting. So it was 8:02 when I got to that door. And I stopped and took a quick head count, and there was 23 women and one guy. And I hustled down there and got a meeting seat right beside him, and we had that meeting, and the meeting was over, and we said the Lord's Prayer, and he turned around and he introduced himself to me. And I said, man, I'm glad there's one other guy here. And he started laughing. He said, I'm moving to Florida in the morning. This is my last meeting here, buddy. I'm turning these gals over to you. And that was just God taking care of me then, and I didn't even know it, you see. Because we sent Curvin on down to Florida, where Curvin could get help if he needed help. Because I was so sick, it's taken all 23 of them for me. And if Kervin had been there, they would have, you know, we wouldn't have had time for him. And I told them gals right there at that bus my group that I didn't need their program. I came in the door telling them, I don't belong here. You have nothing that I need. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm only here to make sure my wife is out there. And as long as she stays sober and doesn't drink, we will be okay. And I meant that. I meant that. And you know what those gals there at Busmer did? They just throwed their arms around me and said, come on in. And they began to very gently, without letting me know, use those hooks to pull me into this fellowship and never told me about it. The first hook that they used was that laughter. Man, I hope we never lose the laughter in our way of life. You remember the laughter when you first got here? Remember how important it was? Hoo-wee, there hadn't been a whole lot of laughter in my life. And I remember that very first night that I was there, we had one of our old-timers that was sharing her story that night. It was a speaker meeting. I didn't know what it was going to be. I just, you know, didn't even know I was going in there. And they got that meeting open, and they introduced her, and she walked up there to the podium in front of that room. She said, hi, my name's Doris, and it's been 14 years since I had to plan a murder. Yeah. And the whole room erupted just like you did here. Everybody except me. I wouldn't have told that. Never say that out loud. Because, see, I've been planning that murder just like you had. I was going to kill her and tell God she died. And then as Doris went on and his thing, and her talk was just full of humor. And I began to see that these people wasn't laughing at Doris. She was laughing harder than anybody. They was laughing with her. So the first hook they used was that laughter. Next hook they used, began to use with me was the hugs. We're a hugging group down there where I come from. We believe in those hugs. We hug you when you get there. We hug you when you're leaving. We hug you during the middle of a meeting if you need it. We might hug you if you don't need it. You know? And they began to, you know, and they knew. See, these guys, they intuitively knew. And that I didn't want to be in there. And so they took a chair and they set it back there by the back door of the meeting room. And they said, Bo, this is as far as you have to come into this meeting. The nights that you're here, this is your chair and nobody else can sit in it. You sit right here. And then they assigned somebody to me. Now they didn't tell me this. So they assigned somebody to me and here's what would happen. And I think they changed on a monthly basis. And the way we close meetings at my home group is we close by standing, holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer. Now, I've been sponsored by old-timers. I've told you that, or haven't I? Okay. Old-timers believe, and old-timers teach you, that the Lord's Prayer ends with the word Amen. So when we say we want to close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer, we don't say or do anything after Amen. That's the end of it. So we would stand up, and we would hold hands, and we would say the Lord's Prayer, and we would release, and we'd say Amen, we'd release, and I'm right by the door. I'd turn to go out the door, and there she'd be. See, she was the one that was assigned to me, and while we had our eyes closed, she'd slipped around. And her job was to give me that going home hug. Yeah. And see, she always whispered in my ear, so she gave me that hug. You keep coming back, Bo, because we need you. If you needed me. And I was going to be bringing her anyhow. And I began to read some of your literature. I didn't tell you that. Okay? And so I came on back. It kept me coming back. It kept me coming back till the miracle happened, you see. It kept me coming back. The next hook that the people used down there, my home group used on me, was a hook that they're still using today, and I still am still learning about it today. I have a little better understanding, but I'm still learning about it. And it's a hook called unconditional love. They just keep loving me and loving me and loving me, and I keep waiting on them to present me with a list. This is what you owe back. And they never give me the list. They just continue to love me and to love me and to love me. And so this kept me coming back until the time came that I realized that I needed Al-Anon. And then the time came that I made Bessemer my home group. Now, this was 7 months into Shirley's recovery, not my recovery, Shirley's recovery. Because see, this whole time that I'm in there just wallowing around, occupying your chair, Shirley's out there and she's got her a sponsor and she's implementing 12 steps in her life and she's growing spiritually. And she's getting well and I'm getting sicker and the gap between us is growing wider. And it took 7 months of this and finally I got to the point that I was sick as I needed to get. And I looked at her one night and I said, tell me what you're doing. And she told me about her sponsor and she told me about her book and she told me about her God. And she said, Bo, the same things are available for you. And I went back to Bessemer the next night and I made the Bessemer Al-Anon family group my home group. And when the meeting was over, I went up to this lady there and that Curvin had gone. So there was no other male Al-Anons around. So I went up to this lady named Fran and I said, Fran, I need a sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? And if Fran was here today, she would tell you that she had a temporary lapse of sanity when she agreed. Fran's old enough to be my mama. And Fran's been in Al-Anon since 1961. And she's a past delegate. And I just talked to her last Saturday morning. And she's got bone cancer. And my gal, Fran, needs your prayers. Needs your prayers. You put Fran in the prayers. So we don't need to lose her. There's too many of me out there that need her right now. She put a condition on it. She said, Bo, I'll sponsor you, but there's only one way. She said, I'll sponsor you the only way I know to sponsor, and that's how I was sponsored. And she said, and that's in the steps. If you're ready tonight to make a conscious commitment to implement these spiritual principles in your life on a daily basis, then I'm willing and ready to take you by the hand and walk with you. And that's 18 years ago, and she still does that today. She does it more by example today than anything, but she still does it. Wasn't too far into this sponsor relationship that we knew that I needed to talk to a man about some issues. So she was wise enough to send me out there in that AA room. And she said, now you get you an AA out there that's working a good 12-step program to talk to. And we'll make him a part of this sponsor relationship. I just happened to pick the one she'd been married to over 40 years at that time. And Jim and Fran have been my sponsors and my guides and my mentors. And it wasn't too long ago that I talked to a man in Atlanta, Georgia. It wasn't Bob, by the way. It's a good friend of Bob's. I talked to him about being a service sponsor and working with me on some things. And so I picked up another sponsor with some really, really good, strong sobriety. And it looks like that, you know, the way things are going, that it might be happening just as it should be. Just as it should. So, I go to a lot of meetings. I got a home group. I'm sponsored. Let me tell you something else. I sponsor folks. There's folks out there that's sick enough and like to ask me to be their sponsor. Yeah. And boy, is that a trip. Is that a trip. And the last thing I would tell you that I do today on a daily basis, in order to tell you I'm a member of Al-Anon, is I take those 12 spiritual principles. And I implement them in my life on a daily basis. Getting up every morning, having that quiet time, talking with God, inviting God into my life, asking Him for direction, and going out there and putting one foot in front of the other and being the best Bo I can be on a daily basis. And some days that's just real easy. Especially when I'm at the party with you. This is the easy place to do it, isn't it? The proof of it's out yonder. And some days out there, I just don't do as good as I think I should. But what I'm beginning to realize is it's really not that important how good I do or I don't do. The important thing is, am I on the firing line? Am I putting one foot in front of the other? Am I out there in action doing what God directs me to do on a daily basis? And these are the things that I do today in order to tell you that I'm an Al-Anon. Now let me real quickly tell you a little bit about me and about how I got here. In order to do that, I have to go back and start with this statement. I was born at a very early age. Now it's necessary that I go back and start there because you see, I don't know how many of y'all know about the Deep South, but I'm born and raised right down there in the middle of the Deep South. Born and raised about 25 miles out of Birmingham, Alabama, in a little small town out there called Hueytown, Alabama. And I'm in the middle of something called the Bible Belt. And I was born into a very strict, very religious Southern Baptist home. Now, I don't know how spiritual we was, but by golly, we was religious. Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night, we was in that Southern Baptist church right there in Hueytown, Alabama, and it was there. What's important is that it was there in that Southern Baptist church, and this went on up through my late teens till I left home. It was there that I formed a concept of God that I brought into adulthood that caused me some trouble. Now, it wasn't the church's fault. I know. I've looked back at this, and I know that the church talked to me about God being loving and God being forgiving. But for some reason, the concept I brought into adulthood was God's going to get you. And a very judging and a very punishing God sitting up there just keeping score and ready to do, because every time Bo did something wrong, there was a price to be paid. And being raised in this Southern Baptist home, I wasn't around any drinking and didn't know anything about drinking. I met Shirley in the mid-teens, and we started dating. She comes from that totally 180-degree different background. She comes from that broken alcoholic home. And she had made a vow that she wasn't going to drink because of all the problems and all the pain that she had experienced in that alcoholic home. So I didn't drink, she didn't drink, totally different reason. We met and we dated for 5 years and we didn't drink. We finally decided we was going to be able to get along. We set the date and got married. Just two kids madly in love. Didn't know a thing about life, thought we knew everything about life. You know, you've been there. And we set out on this thing that we called a Great American Dream. And the Great American Dream was centered around something called a dollar bill. Because what we knew about life was that successful people worked hard, made lots of money, and bought lots of nice stuff. And the bigger your house was and the more stuff you had, the more successful you were. And we wanted to be successful. So she had a good job, and I had a good job, and we set out on this thing. And it took us a year, and we saved up enough money, made that down payment on that home out there in Hueytown. You know, that one out there in the tract, in the suburban tract. Three little bitty bedrooms and a smaller bathroom. A big, huge backyard fenced in with a chain link fence for the kids. You know, everything just, and boy, we was off and running. We had the house. 3.5 years after we was married, God gave us the most beautiful blonde-headed, blue-eyed baby boy that a daddy could ever want. And Mike became a part of the Great American Dream. 17 months later, along comes Sissy. Brown-headed, brown-eyed, just as gorgeous as she could be. And Sissy became a part of the Great American Dream. And we took stock. We had two kids. We had two cars. And we had a house. And everything we had was mortgaged to the hilt. And we was happy, chasing the dollar. But we had to have two jobs, so Shirley had to go back to work. And it's when she went back to work that she was asked to join a social sorority there, and she did. And it was at one of these sorority parties down on the Warrior River, not too far out of Hueytown, late in the summer there one year. You know, it's like August. And in August in Alabama, it's 100 degrees temperature and 97% humidity. You stand in the shade and just sweat. And this was the kind of time it was, but we were down there at this people's river house, gorgeous place. And the lights are down low and the party is outside and the music is soft and there's a gentle breeze and the moon's reflecting off of that river. And I hand my wife the first drink of alcohol she ever had. I said, here, honey, drink this. And it wasn't but a couple of years later, she's right up in my face and she's saying things like, Bo, if you had never given me that drink, I wouldn't be the way I am today. Well, you see, we didn't know anything about alcoholism. What I knew was that mine and Shirley's relationship was changing, and not for the better. And I knew that our family relationship was changing. And I knew that our financial situation was changing. And I knew that those troubles had started right after the drinking had started. So what I did was I agreed with Shirley and I took on a load of guilt that I was to carry as long as the drinking continued. And I carried that load of guilt until I found the doors of Al-Anon. And it was a load of guilt that almost got to be more than I could bear. Now, I could stand up here for the rest of the afternoon and share war stories with you about our trip through active alcoholism. And I love war stories. You know, war stories are just, they're fun. Maybe some of you don't know what war stories are. Let me explain this. War stories go like this. We're in the hospitality room and we're sitting around and we got coffee and we're just talking and cutting up and sharing things. And I begin to tell you about cutting my little finger last week. Now, I didn't cut it bad, but I cut it right there where it bends. And it was just bleed. And then just about the time I'd get it to stop bleeding, I would forget and I would bend it and it'd start bleeding again. It was just real pesky, you know, just real pesky. And then Lou Ann's sitting there at the table with us and she said, well, you're talking about a paper cut, Bo. She said, my goodness. She said, 3 years ago, she said, same little finger on my hand. She said, I cut it. I was working out there in the yard on my flowers, and I cut it. And so we went to the emergency room. It took 37 stitches. So when they got through stitching my finger, you couldn't even see the finger. All you could see was stitches. Yeah. And then John sitting there with us. And John said, y'all don't know anything. He said, 5 years ago, he said, I was unloading some of my taping equipment. He said, I dropped it and it hit that same right. He said, it cut my little finger off. And it grew back. So that's what I'm talking about war stories. I tell one, you got to tell one's a little bit, you know, a lot like a first step meeting. But I've learned something about war stories over the past few years, and what I've learned is that my war stories and your war stories are the same. Yeah. All the fingers are different, and the hands are different, and the times are different, and the names are different. To get all that out of the way, you know what's the same? The pain. That's what war stories are about. The pain is the same. And we all hurt pretty much alike. I want to share with you two or three of the pains that I experienced on our trip through active alcoholism. First pain I share with you is that pain of guilt that I've already told you about. That was to get heavier and heavier and heavier as long as the drinking continued. The next pain I share with you is a pain called anger. Now, I don't know about you, but let me tell you about me. On a good day, I got up angry and I went to bed angry. On a bad day, I got up angry and I went to bed in a blind, running rage. And toward the end of the drinking, if you had sat me down and talked to me, I probably couldn't have told you who or what I was angry at or about. I just knew that everything that was happening in my life was a legitimate cause for anger. I was certain of that. The next pain I'd share with you is a pain called resentment. And I didn't know what resentment was till I got here and you taught me. But as I look back, I realize I was living my life full of resentment. Because you see, the time had come now that if you lived up the street from me and I saw you and your family out in the yard cutting the grass or washing the car or cooking out, doing something together, I resented you because alcoholism had taken that away from us. We didn't do things together as a family anymore. If I saw you and your family get in your car and pass by my house going somewhere together, I resented you. Because alcoholism had taken that away and we didn't go places together anymore. And when you went by my house, if your car was nicer than mine, I resented you. Because alcoholism had taken the nice things and we didn't have them anymore. The biggest resentment of all is I resented God. Because you see, God was continuing to punish me in motion by giving her the first drink. And this was my relationship with God when I found the doors of Al-Anon. Very judging and a very punishing God. The next pain that I would share with you is a pain that I hear alcoholics talk about a lot. And it talks about it in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a pain called loneliness and isolation. And I believe you, alcoholics, when you say yours is a disease of loneliness. I believe you. What I want you to know is that you don't have a corner on that market. I know about loneliness and isolation too, and it doesn't have anything to do with how many people are in the room. Some of the loneliest times of my life have been in crowded rooms, surrounded by what I thought was the best friends I had, and probably they were at that time. And they would be sitting there and they would be cutting up and joking and laughing. Genuine laughter. And I'm sitting there with that fixed smile. You know the one we had, the one that hurts your teeth. Yeah. And I'm wanting to cry out to you and I'm wanting to say, how can you be so happy? If you lived in the life that I lived in, how can you be so joyful? And I would want to say to you, I've got a drunk wife at home that I can't sober up. Can you give me some help? But I couldn't ask you that, you see, because if I ask you that, I owned up to the other pain that was consuming me, and that's a pain called failure. See, I'm the Southern dad. And I'm the husband and the father and the head of the house. And I'm supposed to be able to fix anything that comes along, and I couldn't fix my drunk wife. And so I sat there and I stuffed it. And I felt lonely and isolated. This is the way I was living my life in July 1982. This is the way our family was surviving in July of 1982. Four individuals living four separate lives under one roof. A family completely torn apart by a disease that we didn't even know we had. Dying of a disease called alcoholism. We had the curtains pulled and we didn't allow you in. And we had that great unwritten rule that every alcoholic home has. And that unwritten rule is you don't talk about it. So what you did at our house is right before you left, you stopped at the front door and you straightened up. And you made sure everything was in place, including that smile that hurt your teeth. And when you hit the road out there, you told the world that we were fine. Thank you. Die. Late July, the kids and I are going to one more softball game. And we haven't asked Shirley to go. And I don't think she wanted to go anyhow because you see, she was a kitchen drinker. And we'd be gone 4 or 5 hours and this would give her time to do what she needed to do without us being there to nag over her. And so Sissy and I had already gotten in the car and we were waiting on Mike. He was 15, Sissy was 13. And we were waiting on him. He was running a minute or two behind. And I'm sitting there in the car and I'm watching him when he gets to the front door and his mom's standing there and she has given me permission to share this with you. He stopped and he talked to her for a minute or two and then he came on and got in the car. And it was some 2 years later before I ever knew because Mike never told me about what was said there for over 2 years. But what was said that night was, as Mike came out the door, he turned and looked at his mom and said, when we get home tonight, you're going to be passed out on the floor, passed out on the couch. Where are you going to be passed out? And if Shirley was sharing her story with you today, she would tell you that for the very first time in his life, she raised her hand to slap his teeth out. How dare him talk to his mother like that? And as she raised her hand to do physical harm to her son, whom she had never laid a hand on before, the thought raced through her mind and the memory raced through her mind of the last time that her drunken daddy had beat her with a belt buckle end of a belt. And she had cried out to him and said, Dad, if I ever have kids, I'll never lay a hand on them. And she made a vow to God, said, God, if you allow me to have children, I'll never lay a hand on them. And here she was with her hand raised to slap her son's teeth out, and she couldn't deny that it had something to do with drinking because she had a drink in this hand. And she didn't hit him. And Mike turned and walked away and came and got in the car. When we got back home from the ball game that night, we knew that something was different because the front door was open and Shirley wasn't passed out. And it was well past her passing out time. And she was waiting up on us, and when I went in, she met me at the door, and she said, "Bo, I can't go on this way. I've got to do something about my drinking, and I've called a treatment center, and I'm going into treatment." And I looked at her with all the sarcasm that I could muster, and I said, "Shirley, this is number 1,382. What's different this time?" And I told her I didn't believe her, and I took a shower and went to bed. And it was the next day when this treatment center called me for insurance information that I even believed that my wife had called. And God directed us to a treatment center about 40 miles from our home that believes wholeheartedly in the 12-step programs of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. And God did that because, you see, there was treatment centers there that didn't treat it that way, and we didn't know the difference. God sent us where we needed to be for just a short period of time, where we could come out of there and turn the corner and walk into your arms, where we've been ever since. Now, you should have seen us that day. We'd taken Shirley off to treatment. July, late July. Hot. I got a pickup truck. Kids put two lawn chairs in the back of the pickup. Got them a cooler of Pepsi back there and a big old blaster radio. Me and Shirley's up front. You'd have thought we was headed to the beach. And off to treatment we go, and we get up there and we drop her off, and just as we're about to leave, this counselor stops us and talks to me, and he says, "Bo, we have something up here called Family Week." He said, "And your kids are 13 and 15, and he said, "We're going to ask you and both kids to come up here and move in on Monday and stay till Friday in a special wing we have down here and be a part of this treatment process." He said, "I'll write you a letter letting you know about it, what the dates are," and dismissed us. We're on the way home, and the kids said, "Dad, we don't know about this Family Week thing. The kids are out of school for summer vacation." And they checked that place out. They said, "There ain't no swimming pool up there." And I told them, I said, "Don't worry about it, kids. We're not going. There's nothing wrong with us." But the letter came. And we don't have time today, but if, you know, sometime maybe I get to tell you about that letter and about how we got coerced up there. And we went up there for Family Week. They call it Family Week. I call it Hell Week. Because that's what it was. Two or three things happened up there that are real important. Number one, the very first thing that happened up there was that the very first afternoon that we were there, they started telling me in no uncertain terms, "Bo, your wife has a disease, and that disease is called alcoholism. And since it is a disease, Bo, you're not responsible for her having it." And you see, I needed to hear that. And they said, "What you need to learn about, Bo, is something called the three C's. The same three C's we have in Al-Anon. You didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it." Well, I knew I couldn't control it, couldn't cure it. I'd darn near kill myself trying. What I needed to hear was I didn't cause it. Because, see, I took that load of guilt up there with me. And it was up there that the process began that I finished in Al-Anon of shedding that load of guilt. Now, I began to learn up there and learned early on, finished that education in the early days in Al-Anon, that alcoholism is a disease and I'm not responsible for her having it. What continues to go on today is the realization and the education that since I'm not responsible for her having that disease, I no longer need to try to be responsible for her recovery from that disease. And that allows me to release her with love and put her in God's hands where she belongs and let her recovery be between her and the God of her understanding. And you know what that did for me? It freed up endless time and endless energy for Bo to work on Bo. Yeah. The next thing that happened up there that's important is they held an Al-Anon meeting for us. They had a lady to come in from the outside hearing the message of Al-Anon. And she did an Al-Anon meeting for us up there that night. And I remember these things that she said. She said things like, "Bo, when Shirley gets out of this treatment, if she's going to stay sober, she's going to go to AA. Period." She said, "Now, if you want to regain your sanity and begin to experience any serenity, then you're going to go to Al-Anon. Period. Not, I hope you do, or I'm here to encourage you to." She didn't even use the infamous, "Why don't you try six meetings?" No, she looked me dead down and she said, "Big boy, if you want what we got, this is where you will go and this is where you will find it." And then just as the meeting ended, she threw the kicker in. She said, "And by the way, if you love those kids at all, you're going to make sure they're introduced to Alateen." Well, where was the oldest, strongest, most active Alateen group in the state of Alabama at that time? Bessemer Al-Anon, right where we were headed. So me and the kids dodged bullets for the rest of the week. We got out. We waited till Labor Day weekend till they let Shirley out. And we went and we picked her up at 12 noon on Saturday, Labor Day weekend, 1982, with instructions to go straight to the Bessemer AA Al-Anon group. That there we would meet up with a group of people that were going to form a convoy and we're going to go 50 miles further down the road to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, the home of the University of Alabama, where we would be going to a thing called an anniversary, the Tuscaloosa AA Al-Anon anniversary. So we pick her up, we head straight to Bessemer and we meet up and, you know, we used to convoy all the time. Y'all ever do any convoy? I loved that. We don't do it anymore. Too many meetings. One on every corner somewhere. You don't have to convoy. You know? We met down there at Saturday afternoon. Must have been 20 or 25 vehicles in that convoy. Like Larry was talking about earlier this in his talk, every one of them was a drunk car. You know what a drunk car is? It wasn't a straight piece of sheet metal out there. We had everything, 2 doors, 4 doors, station wagons, Suburbans, pickup trucks, had it all. And every one of them was just crammed full. Didn't the air conditioner work in one of them? People hanging out the windows and down the road we go. And we get down there to Tuscaloosa on the campus of the university and we walked into a room much, much, much bigger than this room. And there was 500 of y'all waiting on us. The party. And that's the way we were introduced to this way of life. You talk about attraction rather than promotion, you attracted us right on in. Let me tell you how good my God was to me at that time, and I didn't even recognize it. This was 1982, folks, and there was a male Al-Anon speaker and a female AA speaker. To this day, I cannot tell you who that male Al-Anon speaker was, where he was from, or what he said. I can tell you that female AA's name, where she lived, and I can still tell you most of her talk. Because you see, I wasn't there about me. I was there about her. Yeah. And we got out of that thing that night, and we went home that night. We got home sometime around midnight. Shirley's first night home in 38 days. Me and her and two kids sat in the middle of the den floor with milk and chocolate chip cookies till just about daylight, and we talked about something called family recovery. And we made a conscious decision and a conscious commitment that this family was going to give this thing our best shot. And so far, that's led us to being right here in Las Vegas with you today. We asked the kids to go to 4 Alateen meetings, and then we would talk with them. We don't believe you can force them any more than you can force a drunk. They went to their 4 Alateen meetings. Sissy, 13 years old, fell in love. Found her home. 2 years later, she was able to sit down and tell us that last summer of her mom's drinking, she was contemplating suicide. Because she couldn't stand the pain of living in that kind of home. And the best me and Shirley did was we missed it. So I'm here today to say thank you to Alateen, Donna, for saving my daughter's life, and then for raising my daughter. She stayed in Alateen until she was 20.
And she came right on into Alamo. She's 31 years old today with 18 and a half years of 12-step recovery. Thank God. Thank God for these 12-step programs. Mike went to his four meetings. He said, "Mama, it ain't for me." But let me tell you about something about our son. Our son lived a 12-step way of life. He didn't go to any Alateen meetings, and he didn't claim to be a member of Alateen. But he was living in a home where the 12 steps were practiced as a way of life. If you live in a home where there's active alcoholism, you're going to be affected. You live in a home where there's active spiritual recovery, and you will be affected. And I'm so thankful today that Mike had the opportunity to live this way of life for a while. And we're kicked off and we're going. And Shirley's getting well and I'm getting sicker. Finally, after 7 months, I get a sponsor and I get involved in the steps, and it's only then that I begin to grow spiritually. I get ready to do a fourth step, and I start trying to write this fourth step, and I'm having all kind of trouble. And I go back to Fran and Jim, and I said, "I'm trying to do this fourth step, and I can't do it." And Fran looks at me just immediately, and she says, "Well, of course you can't." She said, "If you're trying to do the fourth step, you got to be having trouble because you ain't through with the third step." And she said, "You're going to have to do something about your concept of God, Bo. Because you're not going to be able to turn your will and your life over to the care of a very judging and very punishing God." And that's when my buddy Jim reached out and took me by the hand, literally took me by the hand, and took me into his study. And he took me into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, into the chapter to the agnostic. And it was right there in the chapter to the agnostic in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous that I found the God that I have today. And that's a God of infinite power and of infinite love. Never-ending power, never-ending love available to me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I got this new concept of God, and I said, "Well, now we're off and running." But no, I continued to fight God, because you see, in that Southern Baptist church that I went to, where you turned it over to God, you had to become a Sunday school teacher or a song director or a missionary. And I kept fighting God because I just wasn't at that time, you know, just didn't want to go back to the church at that time. And God let me get he worked with me then like he works with me today. Let me get just as miserable as I needed to get. And finally, I just got so miserable that I hated me. And I didn't know how to get away from me. And I started to work one morning, and it was a Wednesday morning, and I was absolutely miserable. And I pulled off the busy street there in Bessemer, Alabama. And I pulled my truck over on the side of the road, and I sat there out of traffic. I beat on the steering wheel, and I did my version of the third step prayer. And it went like this: "God, I don't know what I've got that you can use. God, I don't know where we're going to have to go to use it. And God, I don't know what we got to do to get it done. But whatever it is I've got, and wherever we got to go and whatever we got to do, let's do it, God, because I can't fight you anymore." And I surrendered. As I look back today, I realize that what I did at 8:05 that morning is I fired Bo as the general manager of Bo's life. And I looked around and I hired the best general manager that was available, and that's God. And from that moment, that 8:05 that Wednesday morning, till right here this afternoon with you, the biggest thing that I've had to do in my recovery is to keep Bo fired and God hired. What time did I start talking? 20 minutes to what? You got any idea how long I've been talking? 3 hours. Since I made that decision, and since I fired Bo and hired God, great things have happened in my life. Great things. Oh, it's not all been a bed of roses. It's not all been the broad highway. We've had our living problems, and I'm going to tell you about a couple of them, because I know I'm running out of time. But I'm going to tell you, the reason I'm going to tell you about these is to tell you what part you played in it. Because that's what's important for you to know.
5.5 years into our recovery. We're recovering financially. We're growing spiritually. Things are just going along well. And our 20-year-old son is killed by a drunk driver. And we were right back to square one right quick. But now listen, because you need to know exactly what happened. Because I want you to know about the recovery in this. We got the news about midnight that Mike had been killed. I went to the phone and I picked up the phone and I called Fran and Jim. And I can remember Fran telling me, "Bo, you got to hang this phone up." And I said, "Fran, I don't want to hang this phone up." I had her phone or her voice on the other end of that phone. And I said, "Why have I got to hang this phone up?" And she said, "Because I can't come to you while I'm talking to you on the phone." She didn't say, "Read page so-and-so and we'll talk in the morning." She didn't say, "Pray about this and let's have coffee tomorrow." She said, "Hang up the phone, boy, where I can come to you." Within 45 minutes of us getting the message of Mike's death, AA and Al-Anon was in our home. Now, the family came, but they were experiencing their grief and they had to go home. The church came, brought the fried chicken, tater salad, and they left. AA and Al-Anon came and stayed. That's what you did. That's what you do. That's what we do. And you came in the door and you looked and you said, "We don't understand this either. And we're not here to explain this to you. We're here because we've got big open arms and soft shoulders and big hearts and we want to put our arms around you and love you through this." And you did. And you started making decisions because we were in shock and couldn't make decisions. And you made good decisions. I'll tell you what about Mike. First, Mike was killed at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night. Last time I saw him alive was 7 o'clock that Tuesday morning. He was leaving home to go to work, 20 years and 6 months old. And he came through where I was sitting in my chair with my cup of coffee about 7 o'clock that morning, tapped me on the shoulder and said, "I'm going to work, Dad." Took about 3 steps toward the front door, turned around full of life, looked me dead in the eye, and he said, "I love you, Dad." And out the door he went. So you see, I'm here today to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and Alateen for teaching us to live that way. I'm one of the few dads walking around that can say the last words I heard my son speak was, "I love you, Dad." Thank you for that. Thank you. Our amends had been made. The wreckage had been done, had been handled. Our life was okay. That Friday morning when I walked up to that casket to say goodbye to my son, there was no "I wish we had." There was no "we should have." There was no "oh Mike, I waited too long." No, it was done. All I had to do was say goodbye. And you people taught us how to live that kind of life. Shorty's got an uncle, deacon in the Baptist church. He came to our house and he sat there for 4 days and he watched y'all come and go. He got ready to go home and he sat out at the table with us and he looked at us and he said, "I don't know much about this AA and Al-Anon thing." He said, "But whatever it is you kids have got yourself involved in, for God's sake, stay there." He said, "I've been sitting in your home for 4 days," he said, "and I felt closer to God than I've ever felt in my life." He said, "The thing that confuses me is nobody talked about God. God was just there." Yeah. And we had to walk through that dark valley, but we didn't have to walk alone. You were right there with us and you had your arms around us. And you're still loving us through that today. I miss him more today than I did then. Birthday was November the 10th. We just came through that again. But that's okay. We're walking through it because you're there. You know, we've got some AA folks that still send us cards on his birthday. How about that? I don't know anywhere else you can get it except rooms like this. So we begin to work through that. Then Sissy gets married. She marries Bob. Bob comes along. He doesn't come along riding a great white steed. Bob's riding the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. 4 years of good, big book, 12 steps sobriety.
He and Sissy get married. We decide to sell the house in Hueytown with the big swimming pool and all that stuff that we don't need anymore. We're land barons. Bought us 2 acres out in the woods, 50 miles out of Birmingham. Bought 2 houses out there, put one on top of the hill for me and Shirley, one down the foot of the hill for Bob and Sissy. And life's getting good again. We got our 2 beagles. They're spiritual. They've got their own out-of-pup group. And in June's a year ago. See, we don't have casinos in Alabama. So June's a year ago, Shirley and I slipping off over to Mississippi to an Indian reservation for a little day of fun and frolic. And we get over there. It's 2.5-hour drive. And we get over there and we walk in and they're paging Bo and Shirley Templin to come to the security office. That's not a good signal. And we go to the security office and there's this message there for us to call home. We call home and we get a hold of a nurse. Sissy works in a hospital and one of the girls that she sponsors is a nurse there, and this girl was the one that we were talking to. She said, "You need to come back home." Said Sissy got the results of the test back that she's been having and she's got an aneurysm on her brain. Now there's no treatment for an aneurysm on your brain except brain surgery. And so we come back home, and all the way home I'm beating on the steering wheel and hollering at God again. And we get back home and we begin then to talk to the doctors and to do the things that are necessary. And Sissy got real comfortable with this. Real comfortable. She put this thing in God's hands. And then her and Mom talked and Shirley got comfortable with it. And Shirley put her in God's hands. And I remained a basket case. And we had about 7 or 8 days there before we found the only brain surgeon in the state of Alabama that does not think he's God. We found a brain surgeon that the last thing he did before he operated on our daughter was they held hands and they prayed in the operating room. God sent us right directly to it. Did the operation picture perfect? Said he wished he had filmed it for his teaching. Absolutely picture perfect. Operated on her on Tuesday morning, sent her home on Saturday morning, and said, "You're well. You just got to go home and heal." And I'm still a basket case, and I can't figure out why I couldn't get comfortable with this thing. 2 weeks later, our daughter wants to say some things to us, and she's not feeling strong enough to sit and talk with us, so she writes us a letter. She's big on letters. And I get home from work and Shirley says, "We've got this letter from Sissy," and she took her part and she gave me my part. And here's what my daughter said to me. She said, "I want to thank you, Dad, for the God that you have in your life. And I want to thank you, Dad, for being strong enough in your spiritual program to share your God with me and to talk openly with me about your God." And she said, "I could not have gone through what I've just gone through, and I don't believe that I could be recovering the way I am without the God of our understanding." And it was picture clear to me, and it was okay. Because see, what had been happening in my mind was I had my daughter back in that same casket that my son was in. But I could not walk up to my daughter and I could not tell her goodbye because there was one undone thing that I didn't know how to fix. How do you make an amend to your grown daughter for not taking her to a church and introducing her to a God as a child? And I couldn't figure out how I was ever going to make that right. And then because of brain surgery, my daughter writes me a letter telling me it's a done deal, Dad. It's done. And I don't have to go to the casket and I'm not going to the grave, but the amend has been made. It's done. Man. What a deal. And I don't know how to do things like that without coming to rooms like this full of folks just like you. You're the one that teaches me those things. So life is back good for us. It's on the high road again. We're living well. I just found out that my job's going to play out before long. We thought we had it monitored where I was going to make it to to 62 and retire early, and we fell about 5 years short. And I began to hear Al-Anon things out of my wife's mouth, who's a member of AA. And she says, you know, Bo, we're going to be okay. We're going to get through this. We will band together. It's going to be all right. And you know what it is? It's going to be all right. I got a message, email message the other day from old Bill S. over in Atlanta. And the message was, he said, well, it's going to be fun to see what God does with this one. And it is. It's going to be okay. Because you know what we're going to continue to do? We're going to continue to put it in God's hands, get up every day, put one foot in front of the other, and do the next best right thing. But we have to have direction to do that, and we have to have folks to help us along the way. Because you see, I've never seen the burning bush, and I've never seen the flash of light. But God speaks to me on a real regular basis, and when He does, darned if it doesn't look and sound a whole lot like you. So you are that vital and that important to me and my family in our recovery. I hope that you've enjoyed just this short trip through our lives and through our recovery. I hope that this is not the end of the road for us. I hope that we do see each other again someday somewhere, because you have now become a part of our life. So now that you are a part of our life, I'm going to close this thing. I want to make a deal with you. Here's the deal. I'm going to keep coming back. Rooms like this full of folks just like you. Now your part of the deal is I want you to keep coming back. Rooms like this full of folks just like us. If I keep coming back and you keep coming back, then one day, just maybe one day somewhere, our paths will cross again as we trudge this road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.